Imagine you are the Monegasque broadcaster. You're participating in Eurovision because it's a contest with great musical value and it promotes culture on an international stage. Representing a microstate that's only 2 kilometers long, you don't have much to work with in terms of resources, but you still want to be part of the party. One year, you send a singer with a dream, and that dream came true. But uh-oh. Tradition dictates that you have to host the next contest if you win, and winning the contest in 1971 puts you in a difficult position. You try to come up with something, anything to bring to the EBU, but alas, it's not possible. Who do you call to host the contest when times are dire and there's nowhere to go? Here comes the BBC to the rescue, and in this week's episode of ESC 101, we're traveling from the sunshine coastlines of Monte Carlo to the rolling hills of Scotland, as we explore Usher Hall and Edinburgh Castle, the venue of the 1972 Eurovision Song Contest. This is ESC 101. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to ESC 101, your home of Eurovision history and obscurity. This is the podcast where we take a look at the Eurovision Song Contest throughout the years to uncover the story behind the world's largest international televised music competition. Welcome to episode 28. My name is Alexander. This episode is an interesting one, as it's a double feature. 1972's contest technically has two buildings as the venue. The main building, Usher Hall, contained the stage, the orchestra, and the audience. However, the jury was gathered in Edinburgh Castle. I imagine the BBC chose a separate space for the jury to show off the grand royal castle that they have to offer in the city, hence why this episode has two buildings in the title. I'll be starting off with Usher Hall and then talk about the basic history of Edinburgh Castle, focusing mostly on the room where the jury resided in. To give you some context on how Eurovision came to Scotland, let's turn back one year to 1971. Monaco wins the Eurovision Song Contest, the only microstate to do so. The astute among you will probably think to yourself, where on earth could Monaco host the Eurovision Song Contest? There isn't exactly a lot of land to work with. Well, apparently the Monegasque broadcaster was ambitious. A little too ambitious, as it worked on a genuine proposal to host the contest in 1972. Apparently they wanted to host an outdoor event to be held in June of 1972, and just for good measure, Monaco was constructing a music hall which the broadcaster tried to help in finishing the construction a little bit faster. It's an interesting thought experiment. What would Eurovision outside look like? Given Monaco's position on the Mediterranean coast and the warm, soothing air surrounding the potential venue, it would probably feel like paradise. Sadly, it would be a nightmare for sound engineers and television crews, so it was, thankfully, declined. The logical thing to do when the winner is incapable of hosting the contest is to turn to the runner-up and see if they want to host, much like the UK did in 2023 for Ukraine. Apparently in 1972, both Spain and Germany, who got second and third place respectively, had no interest in hosting the contest. So the EBU continued down the list to fourth place, asking the BBC to host. Not wanting to deny themselves the opportunity to show itself off, the BBC said yes. They narrowed the venue selection down to Edinburgh, and they went with Usher Hall to show off the pride and joy of Scottish architecture. When planning the contest, the BBC had wanted to use two spaces from the beginning, as Usher Hall didn't have the space to hold the jury. Thus, Edinburgh Castle was selected because it was a different environment from the modern-looking set in Usher Hall, a contrast between tradition and modernity. Now that you have the context on how the contest came to Edinburgh, let's dive into the venue of the 1972 Eurovision Song Contest. Usher Hall, as mentioned earlier, was the venue of the 1972 Eurovision Song Contest. The story of the hall begins with Andrew Usher, 1826 to 1898, where the venue derives its name. Andrew was a Scottish whiskey distiller and blender. Some in Scotland call him the father of Scottish whiskey, as he managed to perfect the blending of whiskey and created a mass distillation process which allowed whiskey to become a mass export of Scotland. Naturally, this made Andrew very wealthy. However, rather than simply acting like a snob, Andrew actually used his money to improve the lives of those around him. He made several bequests to the city of Edinburgh, including a £100,000 donation to build a new concert hall. To put that into context, £100,000 in the 1890s could buy you over 3,600 horses or over 10,000 cows. And in modern money, it's the equivalent of around 8.2 million British pounds. That's a lot of money for a concert hall. But you may ask yourself, why does a whiskey distiller want to build a concert hall? Well, in simple terms, because why not? The story of how this came to be apparently started with a conversation Andrew had with his jeweler on Rose Street. He professed his dream of creating a venue that would become a center to attract musical artists and performers for the citizens of Edinburgh. Apparently, his fondness of music left him longing for a dedicated space to listen to music, and rather than simply whine about it, he gave the city of Edinburgh the money and told them to build it, and they did. Edinburgh didn't have a dedicated music hall, and they were grateful for the bequest to build one, and they got to work on it right away. Unfortunately for Andrew, he was 70 when he donated the money, and he didn't live long enough to see his dream come true. He died in 1898, and the hall's construction wouldn't be complete for another 16 years. 12 of those 16 years consisted of a delay, mostly due to the fact that they couldn't find a suitable site. Now, I know that sounds ridiculous and silly. Why didn't they just build the darn thing? Well, because Edinburgh's geography is a bit tricky. The city consists largely of seven hills, including a rocky crag, which is the remnant of an extinct volcano. There are narrow landforms in the area, and planners have to be careful when building in Edinburgh. There's not a lot of flat land to work with, so I kinda understand the 12-year delay. It's a shame it took that long, but what can you do? In 1910, a competition was announced to design the hall, and from 130 entries, the winning bid came from Stockdale Harrison and Howard H. Thompson of Leicester. The design was classical, with Beaux-Arts influences from 1830s Paris, which was a counter-design to Victorian Gothic style. In 1911, King George V and Queen Mary each laid a memorial stone alongside a foundation stone which contained a time capsule, holding a lead casket filled with coins of the realm, a copy of The Scotsman, a copy of Andrew Usher's Deed of Gift, and other items from the period. Usher Hall was officially opened by Andrew's widow, Marion Blackwood Murray, on March 6, 1914. Three celebratory concerts featured music from Handel, Bach, and Beethoven, partially to test the limits of the building's acoustics. A newspaper the following day reported on the opening, saying, quote, "It is not too much to say that those present who saw the hall for the first time were greatly struck with its dignified proportions, its open and airy aspect, and the character of its decorative detail." The building itself features curved walls, which for the 1910s was unusual. This was made possible through the developments made in reinforced concrete. The dome was designed to reflect the curvature of the walls, and thank goodness the interior is not domed, as it would have been a disaster for the sound. Having a dome would trap incoming sound within its curved walls and would take away from the experience. The interior of the hall hosts several decorative plaster panels by Harry Gamely, 1865 to 1928, which feature several prominent individuals in the world of music as well as famous Scots. Examples of people featured include Robert Burns, a Scottish poet widely celebrated in Scotland and Scottish-rooted churches, Sir Walter Scott, a historian and novelist, as well as Bach, Handel, Mozart, Brahms, and many others. On the outside of the wall, there are two large figures which represent the concepts of inspiration and achievement, in addition to three figures depicting music of the woods, sea, and soul. The hall itself has hosted a number of different events, both musical and non-musical. It's played host to political, religious, and even sporting events. Famously, in 1914, Prime Minister H.H. Asquith gave a speech entitled The War, where he used the occasion to recruit soldiers from the all-male audience. Fundraising concerts were held in the 1930s for the Republican movement in Spain. However, the hall's use for politics came to an end in 1934 when Sir Oswald Mosley used the venue to speak and over 6,000 people protested outside, leading to injuries. In terms of sporting events, the 1986 Commonwealth Games used the hall to host the boxing tournament. Quite an interesting space to hold a boxing tournament. Other historical uses include hosting the Vienna Philharmonic in 1947, the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, who played there regularly, as well as other Scottish orchestras and local organizations. Of course, the hall would host the 1972 Eurovision Song Contest on behalf of Monaco. The layout of the hall has changed since the 1972 contest. However, when looking at the footage from the contest, there are some fascinating notes. The stage itself is a separate set, using custom design elements rather than the hall's original design. The set itself is very plain, with added geometric patterns. The main back wall consists of panels of a white-beige color, while accents of blues, gold, red, and green run alongside the edges of either side in a vertical pattern. On the top of the two main walls lies a painted-on Eurovision logo, this version being the old circular logo with the letters scrolling along the edge, broken up by spotlights between each letter, and the phrase Eurovision Song Contest 1972 is scrawled along the upper edge of the wall in the middle. What's strange about this overall design is that the doorways to allow acts on and off the stage are covered with streamers, kind of like what you would use at a birthday party. It honestly cheapens the entire look of the contest, which is disappointing. The shiny curtains sometimes distract from the performances, and it's annoying to deal with. Another interesting feature on the left wall from the audience's perspective is a large screen. Rather than filming postcards, the camera shows the screen, which displays a photo of the artist as well as the song title. However, rather than keeping the screen off when songs are being performed, there are video sequences of what I can only describe as psychedelic patterns. Some are curves of lines, while others are swirls. They're in black and white, so it stands out against the lights and other features, but it's fascinating to see the various patterns kind of flow during the performance. Some are repeats, but it honestly doesn't add anything to the performance. The screen doubles as a live video feed for the audience to see the juries as they vote. I'm also going to go ahead and assume that they showed the interval act for this contest as it wasn't done live in the hall. You can see during the contest the host sits in a chair in the middle of the stage while she looks on to the live feed of the juries as she asks for the results from each group of jurors. The stage itself is mostly round, with small wings on either side, the right wing holding the host, executive supervisor, and the assistant supervisor during performances. The orchestra sits right below the edge of the stage, and there's a physical half wall placed to separate the audience from the orchestra. This is an interesting design, and it helps to keep the conductors safe when going to and from their post. The orchestra consists of 44 pieces and is laid out across the curve of the stage on the floor. The audience sits in what looks like comfortable theater-style seating, the trims being a brown beige with what looks like dark wood accents. The hall itself boasts three main levels of seating, so there's plenty of views to choose from. And of course, the cameras and lighting would take up portions of the space to film the contest. The scoreboard itself is a completely separate piece. I have no idea how they got it onto the stage as the transition was masked by the interval act, but it looks like the board is a separate apparatus that they wheeled onto the stage somehow. It's not present during the performances and appears only after the interval act. The scoreboard mechanism is quite loud as the numbers flip as the votes come in. Each country name is labeled in the running order and there's enough room for three-digit votes. The font used is very 1970s, consisting of some kind of double-lined font, tightly grouped together to form very curved lines for the letter, especially for the letter N, which looks like an upside-down U. Of course, after the Eurovision Song Contest in 1972, Usher Hall went on to host multiple artistic events. The venue is still owned and managed by Edinburgh City Council. However, with age comes the need for renovations, and plans for renovations had to be drawn up quickly because of a not-so-little incident. In April of 1996, just hours after a concert was held in the hall, a large piece of plaster fell from the roof onto the floor of the auditorium. Thankfully, no one was in the hall at the time, and only three chairs were damaged. The council embarked on a £25 million investment to make the building safe and to install improvements, including new catering and ticketing facilities. However, controversy abounds as the project collapses due to funds being withdrawn late into the design phase. Renovations were attempted again in 2002, with another £11 million needed to facilitate the work. In 2007, work finally began, and the council took 3 years and a total of £40 million to complete the renovation, including the construction of a new glass wing. So when you visit Usher Hall today, it looks a bit different than it did in 1972. Of course, Usher Hall wasn't the only building the BBC used to host the contest in 1972. As I mentioned earlier, Usher Hall didn't have the space to hold the jury on site. Ever since the executive supervisor of the 1969 contest failed to do his job and pick a winner, the voting formula went on a complete redesign. In 1971, the EBU introduced a new voting system where two jury members from each participating country would physically go to the contest and vote on site. Votes would be conducted live after each performance, and jury members could not give 0 points. I'll save my thoughts and comments on voting systems in Eurovision for another episode, but essentially setting up a separate viewing space that'll hold 36 people with adequate space to vote and display their votes to the camera was not possible in Usher Hall. The director of the program, Mr. Terry Hughes, decided to hold the jury up in Edinburgh Castle. There's no concrete reason as to why, but I theorize it was to show off the classical and royal element of Scotland, placing the jury in a space with authority. The royal castle of the Kingdom of Scotland allows the jury to be seen with an air of authority and stability rather than being in some random room. Edinburgh Castle was built in the 11th century, playing a prominent role in Scottish history, serving a number of functions including being a royal residence, a treasury, national archive, prison, military fortress, and a royal mint for producing coins. The castle's history is extensive, and I won't give you the entire history, otherwise this would quickly turn into a university lecture. Instead, I'll give you a condensed version and focus on the room where the jury was placed. The castle is built on top of an extinct volcano. Talk about hardcore. The castle itself was involved in countless wars and other historical events in Scottish history. The castle slowly stopped being regularly used in the 19th century, when a mass prison break took place in 1811, where 49 prisoners escaped via a hole in the south wall. By 1814, the prison was beginning to close, and the castle started becoming a national monument instead. While converting the castle into a national monument, authorities were given permission to search the castle for the long-lost crown of Scotland, which was believed to be lost 100 years earlier. They broke into a sealed room, and they found a locked chest which contained the Scottish crown jewels. It's very Tomb Raider, minus any enemies. The jewels were put on display, and the public could view them for a shilling. In 1822, King George IV visited the castle, the first reigning monarch to do so since Charles II in 1651. Over the next century, the castle was remodeled and proposals came and went to make changes, including a proposed 50-meter keep as a memorial to Prince Albert, Queen Victoria's beloved husband. Queen Victoria was famously dedicated to mourning her husband, but strangely enough, she objected to the memorial and it was cancelled, which is really out of character for the Queen. She spent decades mourning the loss of her husband. You figured she'd want to memorialize him everywhere, but apparently not at Edinburgh Castle. The castle today is a scheduled ancient monument, passed on to the care of Historic Scotland. It was designated a World Heritage Site by UNESCO in 1995, and solar panels were installed on the roof of the war memorial. Very environmentally friendly. Turning ourselves into the castle, we find ourselves in the Great Hall. This is the room where the jurors were held. Each jury member watched the contest while sitting at a specially built table in groups of six, set in two layers, with three countries being grouped together per table set. The Great Hall itself is the central space that held the State Assembly in the castle. Oddly enough, there is no evidence of the Parliament of Scotland ever meeting in the room, but essentially affairs of state would be conducted in this room. Historians disagree when the hall was built, but it's usually argued that it was built sometime in the 16th century. There are decorative stone corbels carved into the supporting roof structure which contain Renaissance detailing, comparable to 16th century work found in France. This highlights the advanced skills Scottish builders had at the time, and it's only one of two medieval halls with an original hammer beam roof, which is an open timber roof truss found in various Gothic designs. The hall was converted into a barracks for Oliver Cromwell's troops during his seizure of the castle in 1650, and in 1737 it was subdivided to house over 300 soldiers. The room was eventually converted into a military hospital in the 1790s and functioned as such until 1897, when it was restored in line with medieval architecture. Apart from being used in Eurovision, the hall is sometimes used for ceremonial occasions, as well as being the venue for Hogmanay Live, the Scottish version of New Year's. Audiences in the venue only saw a black and white feed of the jury as it voted. However, television viewers got the full color experience. You can see the red carpet and the beautifully designed wood panel features in the back. It's an absolutely stunning location to host the jury, and it honestly gives them an air of class and sophistication, something I welcome in this contest. And that is the story of the venue of the Eurovision Song Contest 1972. If you're interested in going on a pilgrimage to visit the venues of the Eurovision Song Contest, I have good news. You can visit both locations very easily. Usher Hall hosts artistic performances regularly, and you can even rent out portions of the hall for private events. And Edinburgh Castle is open to the public for tours and other experiences. If you ever find yourself in Edinburgh, I highly encourage you to check out both spots, as well as taking a stroll down many of Edinburgh's historic streets and parks. Before we close today's episode, it's time for Song of the Week. This is the part of the show where I share a Eurovision entry that I absolutely love, or maybe it's horrible. Perhaps I can't stop listening to it, or maybe it's entirely forgettable. Let's find out which entry gets Song of the Week. This week's Song of the Week is the 1958 Swedish entry, Lilla Starna, Little Star, sung by Alice Babs. Composer Åke Gerhard, lyricist Gunnar Wersen, conductor Dolph Vanderlinden. It placed fourth, getting 10 points. It got 3 points from Switzerland and Luxembourg, 2 points from the Netherlands, and 1 point from Austria and Belgium. This is Sweden's debut at the Eurovision Song Contest. It's weird to think that a powerhouse like Sweden has deep roots in the contest spanning all the way back to the 1950s. This song is lovely. It's very relaxed yet composed. The singer is wearing a very culturally appropriate outfit, and considering it's the 1950s, I imagine countries took the whole showing off your culture thing very seriously. The song is about a little star, twinkling above in the night sky, as the singer recalls the hopes of a teenage girl hoping and praying for the love of her life to sweep her off her feet. Lyrics from the Diggiloo Thrush website read, "Little star up above, answer me, is he coming, the man that I will love? Yes, you'll probably know who he is. Will I read in his eye the same answer, that I think I see you twinkling to me now, you little star?" It's comforting to know that young love was just as hopelessly romantic as it is today. The little star represents the glimmer of hope that the singer proclaims in her ballad of love, and for its beauty and its simplicity, Alice Babs' Lilla Starna gets Song of the Week. It's always interesting to learn about the history of various venues which hosted the Eurovision Song Contest. While some fans, including myself, wanted to see the contest in 2023 hosted in Glasgow, I'm glad that Scotland's had the opportunity to at least host the contest once, and that the venue still stands to this day. Usher Hall was even used to host Eurovision Young Musicians in 2018. Thank you for listening to this week's episode. If you'd like to get in touch with your thoughts or comments, you can reach out to our Instagram page at ESC101podcast. You can also send us an email, ESC101podcast@gmail.com. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss out on future episodes. And if you haven't already done so, please consider leaving a review as it helps make the podcast more visible to Eurovision and history fans like yourself. Next week, we are returning to the Eurovision Travel Guide, so be sure to stay tuned to find out which country we're visiting next. Spersa ne vedem saptamuna vitoare. You have been listening to ESC 101. See you next time.